How dangerous are surgeries when your surgeon's been up all night?
Does lack of sleep increase your risk for developing the common cold?
What should we do about that age-old problem, chronic sinusitis?
And does treatment of Chagas heart disease with an antibiotic help?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, hosted on September 4th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science System in El Paso, where I'm also the dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. Elizabeth, before we get started on the articles, I'd just like to say it was nice to hear from one of our listeners, Armando Lorenzo, who just recently published a paper saying that the use of sonography for diagnosing or managing undescended testicle in boys was not very helpful and overused by physicians in Canada.
Not only that, but of course, it's a study that it's the kind of thing where common practice is called into question and examined with some rigor and found out to not be very helpful. So it can be safely eliminated then.
With that, Elizabeth, let's start talking about treatments. Where do you want to start?
I'm going to start with the one that you picked and the one that I pushed back on. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine, the management of Chagas cardiomyopathy.
The reason I picked this is in our 10 years of recording, we've never talked about Chagas heart disease. And it's one of the most common forms of heart disease in Latin America. It's actually caused by a parasite called Trypanosoma cruzi, or we shorten it to T. cruzi. And there are 6 to 7 million individuals affected with this. There are two phases. There's an acute phase, fever and maybe some muscle aches. It's a self-limited disease. But then what happens is over the next decade or two, about 20% of individuals will actually develop a cardiomyopathy, a weakening of the heart muscle that increases the risk of death, lethal arrhythmias, heart failure. So it's a really common problem, especially in Latin America, where there are almost 37,000 new cases of these each year. Now, certainly antibiotics help with the acute infection, but it's not certain whether the heart disease that manifests itself a decade or two later is due to ongoing infection of the heart muscle or whether it's an ongoing immune reaction. What these investigators did was prospective, involving over 2,800 patients with Chagas heart disease or cardiomyopathy, and they placed them on placebo or benznidazole. They followed them over a course of over 5 years, and they looked to see whether the individuals developed either death or had a cardiac arrest or developed significant rhythm problems or heart failure or a stroke. And what they determined was about 30% of patients treated with placebo developed one of these complications, and about the same amount that received the antibiotic.
Too bad. Sounds like back to the drawing board then to find out what is effective with regard to eliminating the infection.
Well, one of the things the authors point out is perhaps instead of waiting until someone has actually already developed heart disease, that it may be the treatment needs to be initiated earlier. This is a disease that I see commonly.
What about interruption of the life of the parasite?
One of the most important things to do is actually to prevent the infection. People have moved from rural to urban areas. It's decreased the risk.
Not everybody can move to the city. This sounds like an area where some research is needed and some prevention. Let's move from here then to another study in the New England Journal of Medicine. I suggested an age-old question. Actually, I said that about the chronic sinusitis, which is an age-old question. But here's another one. Since we've had formal medical education, wow, when we keep our providers up all night and then we ask them to do a procedure in the morning, what's the impact of that with regard to safety?
And as you mentioned, the effect of sleep deprivation and fatigue on physician performance has really been of interest for many years. A lot of the studies have been done in residents or trainees. Few studies have actually examined the effects of sleep deprivation on attending physicians that have been in practice for a while. If a physician has been working at night and you're having an elective procedure during the day, you may not want that particular physician doing your elective procedure because the fatigue, perhaps poor performance, might lead to worse outcomes. But nobody's really ever studied that. So that's what these investigators did. This is a population-based study. It's retrospective. It was done on Canadian physicians who performed elective procedures either after they had done some work between midnight to 7 a.m. or the same physicians on a day in which they had not been treating patients after midnight. They looked at almost 40,000 patients treated by over 1,400 physicians, and the authors found no significant difference in the primary outcome of the patients, whether the patients experienced death, readmission, or a complication
so that if one is scheduling an elective procedure with a physician who is experienced and may have worked the night before in that subset, then maybe this isn't a concern. In some respects, I'm not really surprised by this outcome. Perhaps the danger zone is really among the trainees or among interventions that are not elective.
So, Elizabeth, I actually was surprised at the results. Do you think your outcome would be worse if your physician may have been up throughout the evening? I think most of us say, yeah, I'm really concerned about that. Now, this doesn't get into the reason why that's not the case. It may be that physicians have a better idea of what their limitations are. It doesn't say how long they've been up at night, whether they're up all night or whether they got 2 or 3 hours of sleep. So we don't get much into the mechanism, but I actually was surprised by the results.
Well, I suggest to you that this is an ongoing debate and that we're going to be seeing more information about it.
I agree.
From here, let's turn to, since we're talking about a lack of sleep, a small study that appeared in the journal Sleep saying, oops, if you don't get very much sleep, you are more susceptible to the common cold.
If you listen to your mother or grandmother, they tell you that those that are better rested are better equipped to avoid an infection. But I was actually surprised that we don't have any solid scientific evidence to confirm that or refute it. Here's how the investigators addressed this. They had people wear wrist actigraphy, kind of like those Fitbits that monitor your sleep activity. And they did that in 164 men and women over the course of a week. After they measured that, they received nasal drops containing a cold-inducing virus. And then they isolated these people, they quarantined them in a local hotel. Did the patients develop a common cold? Was it somehow related to sleep deprivation? They didn't change the sleep, they just monitored it prior to introducing the rhinovirus into the nasal cavity. And what they discovered was the participants who slept 6 hours or less during the pre-infection interval had a fourfold higher risk of developing a cold than subjects who slept 7 hours per night.
Pretty fascinating there, huh? And I would say to you, sir, physician healed thyself, I think that this is, of course, evidence that getting enough sleep is probably a very beneficial choice with regard to maintenance of health.
So I had to laugh, Elizabeth, because last night around midnight when I was going through all the studies getting ready for our early recording and realizing I wasn't going to get 6 hours of sleep, I thought, okay, if I take this to heart, I do have to change my behavior a little.
I'm not surprised at all by the results of this study. I will have to say that I have to give kudos to the folks who are willing to have a rhinovirus dropped into their nasal passages to see whether they develop a cold or not. I don't think I'd volunteer for that.
I think this is a great study.
Well, I guess one question I would have would be, why didn't the participants get adequate sleep in the week previous to the infusion of the virus? Was that a habitual thing with these folks where they frequently didn't sleep more than 6 hours a night, or was it something that was specific to an event?
Good question. There's acute sleep deprivation, and that's thought to actually decrease one's immune response. There's habitual sleep deprivation that actually is thought to increase inflammation. The acute sleep deprivation may make you more predisposed to developing an infection. Habitually, the increased inflammation can actually make the symptoms worse. This particular study didn't address that because all we had was a week of recording.
Interesting. More on that, I'm sure. And finally, speaking of colds, what about chronic sinusitis, something that many people seem to complain of after they have a cold, this persistent, yucky discharge, congestion, all the rest of that stuff. What should we really do about that? That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Chronic sinusitis actually affects about 1 in 20 people in the United States, accounting for about 1 to 2% of total physician visits. It's characterized by having inflammation of the sinuses that lasts for longer than 3 months. It's not just clearly infection. There are a lot of different causes or etiologies, and inflammation happens to be the thing that ties it together. What are the most effective treatments in adults that have chronic sinusitis? So these investigators did a systematic review of over 60 years of data. And here's what they discovered. The evidence supports daily high volume saline irrigation with topical steroids as first line. After that, therapy diverges based upon whether people have nasal polyps or not. The polyps can make it difficult for drainage. For individuals that do not have polyps, a prolonged course of antibiotics may be useful, 3 months. But for those that do, either a short course of oral steroids, the topical steroids, a very short course of antibiotics, or a particular group of medications called leukotriene antagonists can be useful. The antibiotics in the patients with nasal polyps are limited to those that didn't respond to first-line therapy and actually have purulent or pus-like material, otherwise not particularly effective.
Was there any information in this particular review regarding surgery?
What they suggested was that the data for surgery is actually very limited. Nasal polyp removal is limited to those patients that haven't responded to all the other medical therapies that we've talked about. So, Elizabeth, we highlight one article on the blog. So this particular week, which one do you want to highlight?
I'm going to do the daytime procedures after night work in NEJM. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.